I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Just a few weeks ago, I heard a woman from my own generation, and both of us are late baby boomers, I ought to say that. I heard her describing how one of the very best days of her life, as she put it, was the day when at school they announced that the dress code would begin to allow pants for girls instead of skirts and dresses. Now imagine that as a high point in life. We boys in the school, we wore pants, and I guess that puts me really out of place to say anything on the subject of how she might have felt. But still, it says tons about social pressures and expectations and power structures and cultural norms and community traditions that a change of this kind, that she was allowed to wear pants, would be so memorable after the passage of four decades. Dress codes must be cultural expectations with teeth, as they say. They have a bite. You can get hurt when you ignore them. Think back on a dress code that you have been beholden to, the kinds of prescriptive instructions you've received, and maybe they have rubbed you the wrong way or made you bristle. However, most of us can safely say that such annoyances were mere annoyances. We are about to hear how history is actually replete with examples of how flouting a dress code has not infrequently resulted in physical violence toward the offender. Even if it's something you wear well, the big question is, can you wear it safely? Well, we have as our guest right now Richard Thompson Ford, author of Dress Codes, How the Laws of Fashion Made History. Ford is a professor at Stanford Law School. He writes about law, social and cultural issues, race relations, and related topics. He's written pieces for The New York Times, The Washington Post, San Francisco Chronicle, also for CNN and Slate, and he's on the line with us now. Richard Ford, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Hi, thanks for having me on your show.
I'd like to begin with you telling us a little bit of a personal story about your own father, because you described the fact that he was trained to be a tailor.
Yes, that's right. He grew up in the segregated Jim Crow South and went to an all-black college where people trained with a profession and also a trade, in one sense, sort of a security in case the racial barriers kept them from pursuing their professional career. He was extremely successful in his professional career, but he did train as a tailor, and he retained that knowledge and that sense of how to identify quality clothing, but also, and more importantly, the power of clothing in terms of self-presentation and dignity and respect. And he carried that through his whole career. And it really made a big impact on me as a child watching him.
So the sensibilities of how to dress, they are something that you picked up on.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And by the time you decided you wanted to go into the law, what you wore and what a dress code might be, those things were all germane.
That's absolutely true. You know, I mean, growing up, I, you know, experimented with all kinds of, kind of subcultural fashion trends. I was into the preppy look for a while and then the punk look and a variety of things. My dad hated some of them. But by the time I got to my first legal job, I had really, come to understand why dignified attire and, a certain refined professional attire was important to my father and why it would be important to me. It was, extremely important to him as a black man navigating largely all white environments in the 1960s and 1970s. But it was still important to me going into my first law firm jobs where, self-presentation and how you dressed made a difference in the way you'd be perceived.
But the stakes were radically different for your father and for you going into the law because of what kinds of penalties might accrue for wearing the wrong thing.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, our society's changed a lot with respect to the requirements of formality. And, but the legal profession is one that's still pretty, at least when I started, was still pretty conservative with respect to dress. And, wearing the wrong outfit would get you some, comments from the partners at the firm or what have you. I made a couple of mistakes myself. So it still mattered.
Oh, would you elaborate on those mistakes?
Oh, sure. So one time I got what I thought was a really great double-breasted suit, and I thought it was relatively conservative, but still, it was double-breasted. And I wore it to work a couple times as a first-year associate at the law firm. And what I had noticed other people wearing similar suits, but what I hadn't noticed was that they were all partners. So every once in a while, I get a comment, particularly from the head of my practice group, "Well, that's quite a suit there." And the first time I thought it was a compliment, but after the second or third time I wore the suit, and it's quite a suit there, I thought, that's not a compliment. That's a comment, and one that's suggesting that maybe that suit wasn't deemed as quite appropriate for somebody just starting off in their legal career. So I wound up saving that suit for the weekends, and going to some more toned down suits.
Did some colleague help to apprise you of this, or how did you suss out the social distinction, the status thing?
No, I noticed it given the way the comment was made. So after the second time, I thought, there's something more behind that comment than I first thought. I better look around and see what about this particular suit, because it was always the same one. I thought I had a few nice suits, but it was always that one that got the comment. What was different? And eventually, I was able to see that that was the double-breasted suit had a certain stature that other suits didn't.
But did you discuss that with anybody, or did you just deduce it?
At that time, I just deduced it. Now, lots of other things I did discuss, particularly with my dad, who had lots of good ideas about how one should dress and what would be an appropriate type of attire. And I got plenty of good advice from him about building a first wardrobe and things like that.
Well, we are going to get into the history of dress codes with you, and you've done some considerable research to see what the trajectory of this issue has been over centuries, actually. And I'm going to leap back well beyond the last couple of centuries, and we're going to go way back to, I guess, maybe England in medieval times, and find out what you've learned. But I want to say that we're jumping back beyond the time of, say, the Los Angeles Zoot Suit Riots. We're going to jump back before the time of bloomers. Where should we pick this up when you first start telling the story of how society kind of regulated this, whether it was official regulation or kind of informal regulation?
Yes, so I'm a lawyer, and so I got into the question of what clothing signified and why it was important by looking at laws. And some of the earliest laws I looked at were what we could call sumptuary codes, and they regulated how elaborate or how sumptuous attire could be, and regulated that according to social status. And so it was quite explicit. If you look at laws throughout Western Europe, in England, for instance, in Tudor England, there were a whole series of what were called acts of apparel. And they specified that only people of a particular social rank were allowed to wear, silk or a particular color. And they even regulated the amount of fabric that could be used in people's clothing according to their status or according to their wealth. And so those laws got me, and they would be quite explicit sometimes that the reason they were passing the law was in order to assure that people would be recognized according to their titles, estates, and preeminences. And so that got me to understand right away clothing played a very important role in establishing and shoring up social power and social hierarchy, and position in those societies.
What were you able to learn about the punitive aspect of wearing the wrong thing back then?
Oh, yes. And the regulations were elaborate, and the punishments could be severe. In one case, someone who wore what was described as a monstrous pair of trunk hose. And trunk hose are these pants that you might associate with, let's say, Sir Walter Raleigh or William Shakespeare. They were kind of baggy and came in at the knees. If they were too large, they were considered to be a threat to good order. And one person was required was had had required to come before the magistrate, where the linings were cut out of his trunk hose, and he was marched through the streets of London with the Lining's trailing behind him as an example, a public example to others. So that's one case. In other cases, the punishment could be as severe as death. So, for instance, when Joan of Arc, who was tried for heresy and executed, one of the main pieces of evidence that she was a heretic was that she wore women's clothing in violation of the biblical admonishment that a man shall not wear clothing that pertains to a woman, nor a woman that which pertains to a man.
So the infraction was actually that she wore men's clothing.
Men's clothing, exactly.
Yeah. This is serious business now.
Yes, it is. And it can still be. Now the laws and the dress codes changed, and over time it was less likely to be explicit legal rules, although those still exist, but much more likely to be codes of etiquette, workplace rules, various codes of conduct. And yet, nevertheless, these rules could be just as powerful and have very important social consequences moving forward in history.
Well, what we've been talking about so far really relates to status and hierarchy. We live in a day where I know that that still pertains, that if you're not, you know, one of the senior members or a partner in a law firm, if you're just starting out in your career, status and hierarchy are involved there too. But the stakes being so high, did this ever make you just scratch your head and almost with incredulity, thinking this couldn't have been the case? I mean, really, was it so important to people that people stay in their place?
Yes, I mean it did at first, and honestly, when I began this this historical investigation, at first I thought, well, maybe these laws weren't really enforced, or you know, maybe they were very rare. But what I found was that they were quite prominent, they were quite prevalent, and they were enforced and taken very seriously. And so, over time, you know, I came to realize that particularly in some of these early societies in the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance, this was a foundation of social and political power. So when someone dressed in a manner above their condition, if a commoner dressed in the way the royalty dressed, that was actually seen as a challenge to the entire political order. And so people did take it very seriously.
One of the biggest challenges to the political order in the history of this country is the idea that people would behave in ways that were not acceptable in their time for their race. And we've got to talk about that after a short break here on Constant Wonder. We're visiting with Richard Ford, Richard Thompson Ford, author of Dress Codes, How the Laws of Fashion Made History. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder, a great topic right now on our show with Richard Ford. Richard Ford is author of Dress Codes, How the Laws of Fashion Made History. We've been talking about his exploration into ancient laws, medieval laws. We're coming now to the United States, and I think we'll talk next about those enslaved peoples who were not allowed to wear, obviously, something that would go against the grain of the people in power. And what can you tell us right off the bat about – I want to hear about specifics about what was forbidden for somebody enslaved to wear.
Yes. So in an example I write about in the book is the Negro Act of 1740 in South Carolina. And that prohibited blacks and slaves from dressing above their condition, enlisted a whole list of things that they were not allowed to wear and were expected to wear. So in one point in the statute, it said that they could not wear anything above what was called either Negro cloth or certain types of plaid. And these at the time were considered to be low status garments. Now, what the people were wearing and people were upset about, and there were newspaper accounts and letters to the editor of newspapers complaining about slaves and black people dressed in the latest fashions from Paris and, you know, walking around town, putting on airs, according to the writers of the newspaper, dressed in a manner that most white people couldn't afford. And this was, again, seen as a real threat to the social order and to the ideology of white supremacy that was dominant at the time.
Were you able to find examples in history of and I'm sure they were there. I just don't know if you came across them, but of people were lynchings conducted on the basis of what somebody was wearing?
Well, I certainly came across examples of people who were chased by racist mobs, and this continued well past emancipation. So, the Negro Act actually entitled white people to take the clothes from blacks who were wearing clothing that was considered to be above their condition. But even as you move through history, there were lots of examples of people who were accosted by racist mobs for wearing their Sunday best on days other than Sunday, for wearing clothing that was just considered to be too nice. And, you know, in some cases, even members of the military who were wearing their uniforms off duty were attacked.
Now, what you're describing here, were there clearly you mentioned the act, which is specific to certain types of infractions, but were there also informal infractions where it wasn't codified in some way that somebody could get in trouble for wearing the wrong thing, but it wasn't in the law?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, many of the instances that I'm describing with, you know, people wearing their Sunday best, at that point, the law wasn't in place any longer to legally prohibit this, but people took offense. A black person wearing clothing that was too nice was considered to be uppity. And, you know, there were lots of instances of people being either physically attacked, sometimes rocks thrown at them by mobs, and certainly, you know, ridiculed in the press, just a whole range of actions designed to kind of put black people in their place.
That word uppity, that's a word to chew on for a bit, because it's so clearly, so blatantly connected with social hierarchy.
Yes.
You know, let's start talking zoot suits now, because this is going to pull us into the Los Angeles zoot suit riot. And a little bit of that story. You know, I had to go to YouTube and learn about this myself today because I'd bumped into it before, but it's been years since I've heard anybody talk about it. And the Zoot Suit Riots were a thing. That was a real thing.
Yes, absolutely. The biggest one was in Los Angeles in 1943. And a serviceman coming back from the war, it had stopped in Los Angeles, and there was a trend in the United States at the time, particularly among African-American and Latino youth, but it also sometimes included whites, certainly some groups of less well-off whites wore these zoot suits, and they were, you know, very voluminous. So they were a suit, but they were almost kind of mocking the conventional suit. And people really took offense. These riots raged for days. People would attack the men wearing the zoot suit, sometimes cut their hair if they wore their hair in a particular style, set the suits on fire, urinate on them. And this also took place in other American cities. So where, you know, Detroit and other parts of the United States, there were many of these zoot suit riots during that period of time.
It seems that there is a continuous theme across the eons here where if somebody is wearing something that might signify wealth and you're not in the right class, that's the infraction, and the signification might just be that, like a zoot suit, uses a lot of material. And you were just talking about the sumptuary laws, where that was the problem too. It uses a lot of material, and material costs money.
Yes, that was one of the ways in which social status was signified, to be sure. Now, there was also a sense that people who adopted the status symbols of the elite often did so in a way that kind of subverted subtly those status symbols. So in a sense, it wasn't only a matter of someone trying to, for instance, pass themselves off as a member of the elite or signify that they were wealthy. Although it was certainly that, it was also that they were changing the meaning of some item of clothing by wearing it in a new and distinctive way. So whether it was in Tudor England, the butcher's wife wearing clothing that the aristocracy used to wear, in one sense signifying now we have a status that's in competition with the aristocracy, or whether it's the Zoot suit, which was a suit, but it was also kind of mocking the traditional suit because of all the fabric, because it didn't have the same kind of spare, sober, businesslike affect, but instead had this very different affect that really rubs people the wrong way. So it's a little of both.
Yeah, rubbing people the wrong way is a euphemism, because if you're doing social parody, you're really mocking the elite.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the Zoot Suit riots resulted in physical violence done to people. And I think by contrast, I don't know, I might be misspeaking here altogether, but if we're going to talk now, going back to what I was saying earlier about my friend who found it liberating to be allowed to wear pants at school, we need to talk about women's fashions now. Yeah. And maybe a little word on the bloomers, but pull us quickly into the 20th century.
Sure. So for centuries, women's clothing had always been draped, particularly below the waist. And that had been a norm that carried on through the 1800s. The bloomers were, you know, some of the first attempts to give women something like pants. And that was a fashion craze for a short period of time, but quickly kind of was ridiculed out of existence. So the next phase of women's reform of women's dress really came about in the 1920s with the flappers. And we tend to think of the flappers now as kind of superficial and just about jazz and cocktails. But actually, they were a ethnically diverse and class diverse group of women, many working women. And they were adopting clothing that was more streamlined. And that was the first time that pants began to become acceptable in some environments for women. You know, before that, women could actually be arrested in some cases for wearing trousers.
Yeah, you know, this all seems so archaic to us today. And yet, we've got dress codes today still.
Absolutely. You know, the high school dress code that you were describing, high school dress codes are still a big deal. Lots of American high schools have what they describe as strict dress codes, and they do affect girls more than boys in a variety of ways. So the gendered expectations are still quite prevalent in our society, where women are expected to be, on the one hand, kind of decorative, but on the other hand, modest. And the tension between, you know, you need to be decorative, but you also, you know, not too attractive, because then you've transgressed in the other direction, is a tension that women are constantly having to navigate.
So you are a lawyer, and you've got to talk to us about how these issues have landed in the courts today, in modern times.
Oh, yes. Yes. So in recent years, at teaching employment discrimination, as I do at Stanford, the number of cases about dress codes is really quite surprising. There are cases involving women wearing makeup. So I write in the book about a woman named Darlene Jesperson, who worked as a bartender in a Reno bar for many years, did a great job, no problems, never wore makeup. And then the new management decided that everyone needed to look their personal best. And that, for the women, required lots of makeup. And she sued for sex discrimination. Now, she lost that lawsuit. The court held that the dress code was reasonable. But there are also lawsuits involving hairstyles, lots of disputes around hairstyles, for instance, that are predominantly worn by African-American women. And a dress code prohibits those hairstyles. There have been disputes around high-heeled shoe requirements for women. Really a surprising number of contemporary lawsuits around dress codes. Usually the employers win those lawsuits, but the tide seems to be shifting a little bit. And there's new legislation, for instance, around things like the hairstyles that I mentioned that would make it unlawful for employers to prohibit those.
You know, this gets so complicated, because we could fold in now also the question of religiously significant attire, right?
Absolutely. So the law actually requires employers to accommodate religious practices, and that includes dress. And so that means that employers have to at least make an effort to allow the religious employee to wear their religious garb. And a lot of the litigation involved head coverings at various times, yarmulkes for Jewish men, headscarves for Muslim women, for instance. Now, the employee doesn't always win in those contexts, but they're much more likely to. And there's, you know, ongoing litigation, particularly involving employers that are image conscious. So a very famous case that went all the way to the Supreme Court involved Abercrombie and Fitch, which is a very image conscious retail store that that refused to hire a woman for wearing a headscarf.
Now, given the way, you know, the march of history is, it just seems that we often have, a fairly facile view that things are becoming more and more liberalized in terms of the prescriptive information we get about what we can and cannot do and where and such. And yet you are one who says there might be some utility perhaps in dress codes, or at least some validation or justification for them.
Yes, I think, there's an idea that we're getting more and more relaxed, but very often the explicit dress code is replaced with an implicit one that's almost as powerful and that can have similarly damaging effects for people who don't adhere to it. So, for example, when Wall Street banks got rid of their suit and tie dress code and said you can wear whatever you want, one of them, and I write about this in the book, said, but of course, we all know what is and is not appropriate attire for the workplace. Now, do we all know? And if we don't, then what happens to the people who don't? Now they don't have guidance. And so what you've seen is that all of these Wall Street bankers have gravitated toward a de facto uniform. There's an Instagram page called the Midtown Uniform. And you'll see all of these people, there's no dress code. They're all wearing a Patagonia fleece and a button-down Oxford cloth shirt. You know, look exactly the same. So at least an explicit dress code kind of puts everybody on the same playing field, level playing field, and gives people notice of what's required. But without that, the judgment is still there, and also maybe the career consequences.
Well, I want to talk about a context now, a social context, where looking like everybody else in your profession is kind of frowned upon, and that's the halls of academia. You know, it's so interesting that you're a lawyer, then you told the story about wearing the double-breasted suit, and on the one hand, you had to sort of comply at the firm, but now in the sphere of education at a university, I would say that it's very common for professors to feel like if you can be kind of shabby, you're making a statement.
Yes, absolutely. So it's interesting that that's almost another kind of dress code. And now in certain areas of academia, what's frowned upon is to look too polished or too fashionable. I write about in the book, there's a study called the red sneakers effect. And what the psychologist doing the study found was that if a professor who wears something quirky or idiosyncratic or is dressed down, and red sneakers were the example that they gave, was considered to be a higher status by the students and by people who observed them than a professor who wore like a suit and tie. And so now it's almost the reverse. There's the idea that one, I am, you know, thinking higher thoughts and too busy with higher thoughts to be worried about something trivial like how I'm dressed. But also, I'm the member of an elite and I don't have to care what other people think about what I wear. And both of those are really communicating status.
You know, it seems to me from this whole discussion that there is no evading the pressure of being self-conscious about how we put on apparel and what it looks like.
That's certainly what I found, that, you know, in one mode or another, people are always assessing other people's clothing. Now, people want to convey something through their clothing, whether it's I'm a fashionable person, I'm a member of an elite, or I'm too preoccupied with lofty thoughts to care about fashion. But all of those are communicating. And if you listen carefully to what people say, you'll usually hear them say it. The flip side of that is that we're assessing other people and kind of judging them based on what they wear. We're trying to figure out what does that attire say about the person, about their character, about their priorities.
Does that make you feel sad for all of us that we're so superficial?
You know, I think it's unavoidable, and there's a bit of me that feels sad about it, but there's also a bit that makes me think, first of all, fashion is fun. Second of all, we care about how we present our bodies, and our connection to the physical body is something that I think we ought to celebrate. And sometimes we celebrate that through fashion. To some extent, the flip side of judgment is appreciation. And so I don't feel sad when I see somebody in an outfit that I think is great. And I don't feel sad when somebody compliments me on an outfit. You know, unfortunately, sometimes the flip side of that is judgment. And I think we could do better at making fair judgments and judgments that aren't exclusive or that aren't racist or sexist. But I don't know that we'll ever get away from making judgments about people's clothing generally.
Now, Richard, just for fun, before I say goodbye to you, when you and I were first beginning to get ready for our interview, we had a little discussion about how to do it by phone or by Skype. We landed on Zoom. And now here we are in the age of COVID. And it's almost notorious at this point that people will go into a COVID meeting and you see them from the waist up and they're probably wearing sweats down below. Have you ever been guilty of that?
No, that's right. It's really the Zoom shirt that hangs on the back of your chair and you just throw it on right before the meeting. Zoom has changed a lot. I think there's still some anxiety about trying to strike the right balance. But the other thing that's come about with Zoom is that people are now looking at what's behind you. So there's a whole phenomenon. There's a site called Room Raider, which is designed to, you know, talks about what's behind the person on the bookshelf. And so people may be less worried about what they're wearing, but more worried about staging the bookshelf behind them to make sure that the right books are showing or that the right wines are on the wine rack.
Your next book's going to have to be about what we drive, right? Richard Ford, such a fun conversation with you. Thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thank you.
Richard Thompson Ford with us. He's author of Dress Codes, How the Laws of Fashion Made History. He's a professor at Stanford Law School. Dress codes can certainly seem arbitrary, silly sometimes. Sometimes they can also prevent accidents, maybe even death. Back in the 19th century, people were often killed by their clothes, either through poisonous dyes or getting bulky clothing caught in machinery. We're going to come back in just a moment with more talk about all of this, this business of fatal fashion. Stay with us for more Constant Wonder. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. In the 19th century, when there were so many weird ways to die, one way that was surprisingly common was getting killed by your clothes. I got that story from Allison Matthews David. She's a professor at the School of Fashion at Ryerson University, Toronto, Canada. She's author of Fashion Victims: The Dangers of Dress, Past and Present. Let's pick things up with the question of whether it's all that much safer now as far as fatal fashion is concerned. In short, the answer is yes. But people still do some crazy stuff, it turns out.
One woman wore her silver antibacterial yoga pants in an MRI machine, which is a giant magnet, and had to press the panic button because it was painful. Felt like her legs were on fire. But yes, we are much, in some ways, as consumers, we are definitely less. We have comfortable, practical clothing for the most part, and it really made me appreciate my washing machine when I started reading about body lice and typhus and contagious disease. So yes, I do appreciate my dress today.
Well, contagious disease, now that you've said that, I suppose that when you talk about the spread of disease, you're going to talk about the vectors. And I guess what you're saying is that clothing was a prime vector, a carrier, transporter of bugs and disease.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's easy to forget that, you know, that this was a problem in the past because many of us have access to kind of easy garments that are easy to clean and that are, you know, easy to care for and wear. Although, again, refugee populations or homeless populations might still have problems similar to historical problems. But in the past, certainly people like sailors or soldiers on campaign did not have access to, or the poor did not have access to ways in which to clean their clothing, and that meant that their clothing became a perfect hiding spot for deadly insects, for example, like body lice. We don't even think of body lice now, but they would hide in the seams of clothing, bite people when they were asleep, and then transmit deadly diseases like typhus.
It was just a few weeks ago I was in the hospital and I saw a lot of people wearing, you know, special attire. And I just presumed it was all sterile attire. But there was some talk not long ago about doctor's ties. Do you remember that?
Yes. I mean, we forget. I mean, sometimes when you go in from a civilian environment, you pick up things on your clothing, and I'm currently also working on that in terms of forensic things, but and crime. But even in medical environments, they did a study on doctors' ties because ties are not something male doctors, and ties are not something that are generally cleaned that often. In fact, they asked doctors, and very few of them regularly dry cleaned or laundered their silk ties, and many of them it turned out to be just full of bacteria, which could be, you know, dangerous for vulnerable patients.
Yeah. I don't want to say it this way. You'll have to correct me, but it's almost as though germs on clothing is one of the most tame strands of what you have to offer in this book. There's a lot of things go up in flames, too, in very dramatic ways. I mentioned the Mad Hatter. Tell us about the hats.
For sure. I mean, I studied hats in detail because I really kind of wanted to understand this whole Mad Hatter stereotype. And I was actually both intrigued and horrified by what I found. It started when I went to the Victoria and Albert Museum to actually look at surviving hats. And the conservators, the people who work to conserve these hats that are, you know, remain to us from history, had put every single hat in their collection, the hats that are made of fur felt, in their collection. And they were in these Mylar bags with, you know, skulls and crossbones on them, you know, the poison symbol. And it really, so I couldn't touch them. I sort of limited my access to them. And it started, you know, making me think, what about the hatters making these hats, or even the conservators who have to work with them? They tested them for mercury, and one of them still contained enough mercury to poison a million liters of drinking water by today's standards. So the mercury is still in there, and it's still potentially a hazard. But the men and boys, usually, who made them were just worked in an incredibly toxic environment.
Why mercury for hats?
It's a great question. And it has to do a lot with the history of North America and the beaver fur trade, basically. Europe hunted all of its beavers to extinction, and so they turned to North America for a new supply of beaver fur to make luxury, mostly men's hats. If you were a fashionable man, you needed a fur felt beaver hat. They were really costly, really fashionable. But, of course, they started running out of beavers as well in North America. They were overhunted. So by the middle of the 18th century, they needed to look to new materials and local materials. So they turned to rabbits and hares, which, of course, reproduce like rabbits. You know, they're available. They're easy to cultivate and to use, except that they don't work like beaver fur. And so what happens is, for beaver fur, it actually has, the fur has a barbed hair structure, which means that when you're turning it into felt, into this material you then mold into a shape of a hat, they felt very well, and they take a long time, but you don't need to use any special kind of chemicals. But the hair in rabbit fur was short, it didn't work very well to felt, so they actually found that if they treated it with a solution of mercury and nitric acid, that it would actually felt better. And so that solution was called a carroting solution because it turned the fur orange, and I love the rabbit carrot kind of thing happening. But it turned the felt orange, and it then made it possible to produce these much cheaper and not, you know, sometimes good quality hats, but using less expensive fur. But the price of that was mercury.
This reminds me of making olives. I mean, who figured out that to make an olive palatable, you had to soak it in, I think, lye beforehand. And somebody just figured, oh, rabbit fur. Well, we'll try some of this acid and some mercury. I mean, to even come up with that is kind of crazy. But that might have been cutting-edge technology in the fashion industry. There was lag time before people knew they were getting poisoned.
Definitely. And even, I mean, the lag time was sort of 200 years. Like, I was sort of reading out, the first medical report on hatters was written in 18th century Paris, and a doctor went and visited all the workshops where they had just started using mercury, and he was saying, you know, nobody lives past the age of 40. They're trembling. They're cadaverous. It's making them all sick. We need to find a better solution. So you see this in 1750. And then still in the 19-teens and 20s, I'm reading medical reports that are equally horrific and just sort of like their teeth fall out in this order. So the poor hatters were just getting, you know, and also examining the psychological effects, the madness, the irritation, you know, it caused trembling in the limbs. So in your arms, you couldn't button your shirt. So these poor hatters were being basically poisoned for 200 years. And it's quite disheartening to read those stories.
Green dye. Of all the colors to symbolize poison, I don't know that I would have picked green necessarily. Tell us about green dyes.
Green dyes. I would have been the first person poisoned by green dyes because it's my favorite color. But basically, green historically was a very difficult color to dye, partly because the components faded. So you could mix blue and yellow, but it wouldn't give you this a great green necessarily or a durable green. So basically, a chemist in the late 18th century figured that by adding adding arsenic to copper.
Well, there we go again, all over again. Let's just grab some poison and see if it changes the color. You know what I mean? It's kind of crazy.
And these were things that were used medically too, though. Like mercury baths were used to treat illnesses, and arsenic doctors had arsenic pills and things so to treat fevers. So these were things that were thought were maybe not necessarily understood as well as poisons as they are today. Yeah. But I think the commercial value of having, so what he created was this new shade of green. And again, we have to think of like lighting. So if you had a great green ball gown, normally the green, if you wore it in gaslight or candlelight, it would just look like a muddy gray kind of color. So you looked really drab and not like you wanted to look at the ball. Whereas this new green he created, his name was Carl Scheele, was called Scheele's green and later emerald green when it became, there were different formulations, all of them using arsenic. But it was an amazing, it was called like a beautiful green, Paris green. It had lots of different names, but it was this vibrant, brilliant, beautiful shade that people wanted to have because it looked great during daylight. It looked great in gaslight. So you could wear, a lot of Victorian women wore one bodice, like a day bodice that covered their chest during the day, but then they would have a second bodice to wear, like lower cut to wear to the ball in the evening. So you could just have this wonderful color covering your entire body.
And were the women wearing it at greatest risk, or does it go back to the people manufacturing it, the textile workers and such?
Well, it's an interesting, this is an interesting story because some of the women wearing this, these were outer garments usually. So unless it was gloves or sometimes the color was done as a pigment so it would powder off and give you a skin rash, for example, if you were wearing it. But the biggest industry within fashion where it caused a problem was the artificial flower industry. And that sounds like, you know, a bit obscure and historical, but there were a lot of women loved to decorate their dress and their hair in particular with wreaths made of artificial flowers with gauze leaves, and some of them are really beautiful, but the leaves were all dusted with an arsenic powder. So it was the flower makers in this case, who were often young girls and women, would get poisoned by using this arsenical powder. And one young 19-year-old girl, Matilda Scheurer, died in the 1860s from working in this industry.
I can see a Puritan walking into this conversation and giving a sermon on vanity.
Definitely. Yes, and that was certainly a lot of female campaigners they actually were very savvy. They wanted to protect these women and girls, and so they went into the media, and they also asked world-famous chemists to test these ball gowns and these wreaths. And, you know, they came back with horrific results. You know, this wreath has enough arsenic to kill 20 people. This dress could poison an entire ballroom, you know. And so they were trying to kind of warn against that fear to scare people away from the color, don't buy this color. And it did eventually work.
Greens today are pretty safe, you think? I hope so.
Sometimes. I do get the odd, apparently one bikini that was dyed green was actually found to be toxic, so it depends. But yes, safer than in the 19th century.
It's not just buyer beware, it's wearer beware.
Exactly.
You know, some of the most... Well, the most tragic – I don't know how you rank these things as more or less tragic. But in the factories, the people manufacturing them, in textiles, there were strangulations just because of – I guess this goes back to the Industrial Revolution or something like that.
Yes. I mean, the place this – I mean, it's not a surprise, but the place that this project came to me was in the Museum of Science and Industry in Manchester, because I used to teach in the UK, and we would take our master's students up to see Manchester and the cotton trade, and they were illustrating just how many problems there were on the factory floor, like children getting caught under machines. But as I looked into it, yeah, definitely, especially female dress and technology did not always mix, because, you know, even working girls wanted to be fashionable, maybe to wear their crinolines in the factories, and you know, things could get caught. lot in these machineries or machinery, and or later, for example, the most famous example is Isadora Duncan with her shawl getting caught in the spokes of the convertible car she was riding in. So this, you know, beautiful flowy garment with fringes looked great, but you know, wearing it in an open car was another matter.
These things actually do happen today. You know, not too long ago, I don't know if it was in the news or on YouTube, somebody was going to a costume party and they wanted to be sheep and they had glued cotton balls all over and not knowing how flammable that was. I think somebody was smoking, you know. Do you?
Yep. These things happen still, rarely, but they do.
Yeah, fire is a big one.
Fire is a big one. And just speaking of that, we just wrote I co-wrote a version for 9 to 12 year olds. So they can kind of, one of the examples in that book is someone who was riding a go-kart with a scarf again. So beware, you know, technology and cars and machinery near, or we're getting caught in ski lifts and things like that. So you just have to be careful with those scarves. But fire, yeah, that was actually, I found in my studies, some things obviously like the mercury and hatting were really, really dangerous for the makers, but the consumers didn't really know about them. So male men wearing those hats, the hats were lined with silk. So the man wearing the hat didn't really get poisoned. But the opposite was true in the case of fire. There were certainly factory fires, certainly with some certain materials. Like if you had like the Triangle Shirtwaist fire, there were scraps of clothing all over this factory, which do constitute a fire hazard. But in terms of kind of individual wearers wearing garments, women were probably at the most risk of fire around the 1850s and 60s.
Well, that might just be enough about fashion concerns for one day, I think. So let's move now from human nature to, well, nature for this last story on Constant Wonder today. A couple of years ago in England, the place was thrown into a bit of an uproar when it was discovered that a pair of raccoon dogs were on the loose in the countryside. That left us wondering, it's what we do on this show, what's a raccoon dog anyway, and how did they get to England? To find out, we spoke with Stephanie Jason, a senior scientific officer in exotics and wildlife trade at the Royal SPCA. Here's a highlight from our conversation.
Now, tell us a little bit about their biology. What are raccoon dogs? Are they more like raccoons or more like dogs?
So raccoon dogs, they look a bit like raccoons, but they're actually more closely related to dogs. They're part of the Canidae family. So they're neither a raccoon or a dog, but most closely related to a dog.
And what makes them different from dogs, even though they're in that same family?
Well, unlike dogs that we keep commonly as domesticated pets, raccoon dogs haven't been domesticated over many years. So they're essentially wild animals that are being kept in captivity as people's pets. So they, in the wild, they need large home ranges in forests, and they like hanging out in dense vegetation. They prey on small mammals like rodents. They also eat amphibians, small reptiles, as well as invertebrates. So they're quite different to the domestic dog that we're used to, the pet dog.
And where do they live when they're in the wild? They live in burrows, they live, you know, in packs. How do they like to live?
So they like to live in forests. So originally they're from eastern Siberia, northern China, North Vietnam, Korea, and Japan. And they're in forests in sort of dense undergrowth vegetation with lots of hiding places and water as well. And they have very large home ranges. But they like to live and hunt in pairs or in small family groups. And social grooming is actually really important. So it is important that we think about that when people are keeping these animals individually as pets, because in the wild they're used to living in pairs or small groups. They also hibernate in pairs as well in the wild.
This particular, I think it's a pair of them that got loose in Clarborough. Weren't they pets?
They were being kept in an enclosure by the owner, but they managed to dig their way out of the enclosure. They're particularly good at digging.
And what are the challenges that people are going to face if they want to keep them as pets?
Well, because these animals are essentially wild animals being kept in captivity, they've still got a lot of the traits that a wild canid, a wild dog has. So They can become more aggressive than a domestic dog. They can become unmanageable quickly. And people will often take these animals on thinking, you know, it's just a cooler or slightly different version of a pet dog. But really, they've still got the same behavioral traits as a wild dog species. So they can become unmanageable, show signs of aggression. And then people will often then contact a rescue center to say, you know, I can't look after this animal anymore. Or unfortunately, some people do then release them to the wild, and we end up picking up these animals as stray animals in the wild.
And what happens when a wild animal that was somebody's pet at one point is then escapes or released back into the wild? What kind of trouble do they get into?
Well, our big concern with something like the raccoon dog is that they could become established here in the UK as an invasive species in the wild, which would really pose a risk to our native species because they've got a similar ecological niche as the fox and the badger. So they could compete with the fox and the badger for food sources, for shelter, and start to affect populations of foxes and badgers. The other risk is that because they predate on both amphibians, reptiles, birds, invertebrates, we could see an effect on the populations of those species as well. So it's very important that we consider this and don't allow them to become established as a wild animal in the country. And in fact, from February of 2019, they've been added onto a list of invasive alien species of European Union concern, which means that this is a species that could easily establish in the wild if it was released. So we need to take measures to make sure that that doesn't happen. So it's now actually illegal to sell the raccoon dog and to breed the raccoon dog as well. So there's very strict restrictions on their trade now.
Do you know if the pair in Clabber has been caught?
Yes. So I heard at the beginning of June that those two were caught after 4 days of being escaped and on the loose. They were caught again and then returned to their owner, who was very pleased to see them back. I know they were very concerned about them. But yes, the modifications are going to have to be made to the enclosure because they could easily dig their way out again.
Stephanie Jason, a senior scientific officer in exotics and wildlife trade at the Royal SPCA. Turns out raccoon dogs are legit, but they still belong in Japan, don't you think? Now, I don't usually pry on this show, but I'm going to ask you a personal question. Do you have a favorite fruit, and is it unusual or exotic? The medlar, the durian, the hedge apple. No, nobody eats hedge apples. Can't do that. Well, we are going to consider some fairly exotic sorts of fruit on Monday here on the show, the kinds of fruit that most people do not bother with or maybe even despise. We're going to visit with a poet who praises difficult fruit. One of our topics Monday here on Constant Wonder. I hope you can join with us then. I'm Marcus Smith. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.